Our next guest has been the public face of the Senior Doctors Union for the last three decades. Ian Powell was appointed as the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists' first executive director in 1989 and only thought he'd stay 5 years. Then the union had 1,200 members. It now has 5,000. And Ian Powell has just retired, handing over to Sarah Dalton. Over the years, he's battled for the pay and conditions of medical specialists, but has also been a vocal advocate for the public health sector. After he left the role, Ian Powell released a report warning that hospital specialists around the country are suffering and that public hospitals have reached a tipping point. Ian Powell is with me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. And just for the record, I don't call it retirement. I just call it not having a permanent job lined up.
Just yet. What is your message right now in a system that is perennially under pressure for many reasons? What is your message about the state of the hospital system now?
Well, as we talk now, it's a system that's functioning remarkably well under very extreme circumstances, which I would call, and we have called in our own publication recently, Hospitals on the Edge, a tipping point. And there are a number of reasons for that, but the ones that come out are there have been the difficulty that public hospitals face is that they are the places that handle everything that the rest of the health system can't handle. So when things go wrong, they require complexity, urgency, etc. There's been a significant growth in what we call acute demand, and that's when it's essentially care that cannot be deferred. It's not necessarily an emergency where you rush into the emergency department, then into the operating theatre, but it cannot be deferred, unlike what are known as elective procedures. Essentially, the growth of acute demand is increasing at twice the rate of the population growth.
Why?
Well, the reasons seem to be, it's difficult to drill down, but in general terms, I would say that we have more poverty in the community, and that's a consequence. And even though there are moves to try and turn that around, some of that poverty is quite entrenched. And the more entrenched it is, the more the chronic illnesses, the more the things that things become more serious. We have significant understaffing in our capacity to actually provide care to meet this demand. Our workforce is not geared up for it. I can only speak for hospital specialists, but I think there are compelling arguments for nursing and some of the other professional groups, as we talk at the moment, like psychologists and radiation therapists. So they are also, but at various pressure points, we are under-resourced.
You skipped ahead, though, as to why we are seeing acute demand increase at double population growth. We have an ageing population, is that a fact?
Well, the ageing population is significant, and if I could just add to that, it's a consequence of that is that more people are frail. It used to be the case where people would say that most things for people will go wrong in their last year of life. You cannot say that with the same degree of confidence now. People are living longer, but that doesn't mean to say that their frailty is coming in right towards the end. It's coming in earlier. So we have a significant part of the population growing that is more frail than used to be.
Comorbidity, which means multiple different conditions. Is that a factor?
Absolutely, yeah. And that gets connected up with the impact of poverty.
The obesity epidemic.
Yes, absolutely. All of that. That's out of control. And we have a recognition at the level of policy rhetoric about social determinants of health. We don't have enough practical measures done to actually do something about that. And so we were quite disappointed, for example, with the minister's decision not to regulate in the area of the food industry in respect of obesity.
If it's increasing, acute demand for immediate care that can't be deferred is increasing at twice the rate of population, how is the system coping? Because you can keep doing more, you can push people further, you can stretch the rubber band so far. Is that essentially what's been happening and happening for how long?
Oh, look, I would say that, look, under the former government, we didn't have austerity in our health system in the same way as countries like the UK, like some Western European countries, Greece, Ireland, but we did have a form of light austerity, which meant that over a period of time there was underinvestment in the health workforce. Well, there was underfunding, but the real consequence, real issue in underfunding is underinvestment in the workforce. So that has certainly been that's happened, and so that light austerity has had an accumulative effect. But this government we have in place at the moment is not actually addressing that sufficiently, not by a country mile. So that's certainly a big factor in it.
So hundreds of millions, if not billions, more going into the health system than might have been, I don't know, X number of years ago. So it's constantly just trying to top up.
Yeah.
But again, when you say that demand's increasing at twice the rate of population growth, that feels literally unsustainable.
It is.
And what are you saying? Just keep pouring more in?
No. Well, first of all, we've got to recognise that there are two victims in this, if you like. Patients with their families, because people are being denied access, that the sort of access that they should be receiving to a range of health services. And the second thing is that the workforce itself is paying for it with its own health, and that's an unacceptable situation. I think it's not simply a question of saying we need more money. We obviously do, but it's got to be focused. And so there's two prongs to that. One is that we've got to actually invest in the workforce by filling vacancies, recognising the level of shortages and doing something about that. That's where the focus needs to be, because it's the workforce that adds the value. The second point, though, is that we need a much more engagement culture in our workforce. Certainly our belief very strongly, and certainly my belief, that if we had hospital specialists, and this could apply to other parts of the workforce, but hospital specialists with a part of having enough time to have part of their problem, their work, they deal with complexity. They deal with the complexity of the treatment of a patient. There's not a big step to be involved in systems improvement in terms of the complexity of this, because public hospitals are complex because of what they are, what they need to be. So if we actually created the opportunity for them to actually be more involved in various systems within their service, across hospital-wide, between community and hospital, then we would actually not only produce a better quality system, a more accessible system, but also a more financially prudent system.
Are the managers still in the way? Are there still too many layers of management?
No, I think that's simplistic. I think the really is the management culture. And we have a culture that's too prevalent in our system of what we call managerialism. And that's essentially that the buck stops with management, and management is actually the right people to make the right calls in various situations. And I don't accept that in the context of public hospitals and the wider health system. Management is important, but they need to be there as enablers to support health professionals, not to direct health professionals.
How does that happen? Apart from budgets, which is one obvious area where you say, well, they're there to enable professionals, but then we're back to the money, and they've also got to manage budgets, and they're accountable as managers for budgets.
Yeah.
So where else are they directing things other than just controlling who gets what money for what resource or what level?
Well, actually, a lot of it is just simply obstruction. You can actually control things by not doing things and making it difficult. There's a lot of innovation that happens in the system already. Health professionals and certainly senior doctors are innovative for two reasons. Innovative for two reasons in terms of improvements within their service. They do it through professionalism and they do it through exigency. They have to keep up, because today's innovation is tomorrow's silo. It's constantly evolving. So, but a lot of that they struggle to get the oxygen to utilise that to the fullest extent. Now, that is obstruction, not at the level of service management. It's very clear that our members, specialists, rate the managers who are closest to the clinical coalface highly. Where they become more critical is those that are further removed and further up the hierarchy.
What are their roles?
Well, they can be at the level of
financial controllers.
Well, not their interface with financial controllers is not really there, but it's certainly chief executive. It's a second tier reporting to the chief executive.
Who
human
are they?
Resources.
Who are they? HR. Yeah.
Yeah. HR.
And comms. Sorry to laugh. I mean, who else is at that level? Seriously.
Well comms are, but yeah. I don't think that's the source of the problem for specialists at the coal front.
Why is that tier obstructive, other than it has competing obligations and KPIs, key performance indicators, that it has to answer to? Why would it obstruct what the clinicians want to do?
Well, they obstruct it not necessarily because they're opposed to it, but because they don't want to do it because of the... Look, I think in an environment of financial constraint, sometimes some people believe that that brings out the best of management. I think that's crap. It's not. There's no empirical evidence to justify it. Some individuals it does, but many it doesn't, because it extends their capacity, expected of them or capability too far. And so I think I would call it short-term thinking. Most good quality innovation and improvements comes through continuous quality improvement and longer-term planning. We have a management culture that is partly forced by its own, forced by the pressures it's under and the limitations to its own thinking in the short term.
Well, we're
and
back to talking to about what outcomes. We were talking about with the banks on Monday or Tuesday or whatever day it was. We're back to the same inbuilt structures, quarterly reports, budget reports, key performance indicators, all set on the short term. In what way is that the case in the health system? Is this again, your budget is blown by X million dollars, which is the case of every district health board at the moment, and a record debt? Yeah. Like, is that what you're talking about? You have to report on that.
Well, you have to report, but I think a lot of the compliance is excessive. But I think people, even if you take the deficits as an example, that first of all, that's a very small part of the total DHB cost. A fair chunk of that deficit is due to issues to do with compliance with the Holidays Act. That could be arguably half of it in most of the DHBs. And in many respects, that should be separated out from the deficits. But I think that the deficits, they are a small proportion. They don't carry over to the next year. The deficit, the operational deficit from on 1 July will be zero because they'll start with a fresh start. If this government was prepared to actually fund our DHBs at the level required to meet the operational costs, not talking about capital works, but operational costs, then we wouldn't have deficits. The data is available to be able them to make a reasonable call on what those operational costs are.
But then you come back to government saying, and okay, there's a big surplus sitting there at the moment. Part of it is actually theoretical because there's been an accounting shift. But there's a big surplus sitting there at the moment. There might not be in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. The position of governments, one after the other, has been there has to be a limit to how much we pour into what is otherwise a limitless demand. People will always want more. They'll want a third and a fourth up operation or this or that or the next thing. Back to where we started with the changes in the population. They'll always want more. And at some point, you have to at least attempt a line.
Oh, look, there's a constant tension between what you need to do and what you're resourced to do. And it's a question to some extent about how close those things come together, but also how they're managed. I think if we actually turned around the culture of our district health boards at the top leadership and that permeated down to give the workforce a lot more opportunity to exercise its creativity and exercise its expertise and experience, we could get a better return
for health. So do the boards get in the way as well?
Not the boards themselves. They're too removed from that. The boards of the DHBs, I take it you mean, elected and appointed. Not necessarily. I think it...
So you're saying the culture of the district health boards, the culture of the hospitals, essentially, the hospital leadership, the managerial leadership.
The top leadership, yes.
You've seen how many different iterations of the health system so far? You'd have been here for the CHEES and the RHAs and the funder-provider split. And
well, I suppose in one sense we've had two main pieces of legislation. We've had the legislation of the health reforms of the 1990s and then the legislation that Annette King introduced that came in the early 2000, 2001 in effect.
Brought the district health boards back got rid of that split, right?
Yes, that's right. But the legacy of that and a lot of mindset thinking continued on. So that have been the two main changes in that sense. What we've had since about 2010 is an acute awareness of our vulnerability on the specialist workforce. We lost a lot of specialists to Australia because Australia had critical shortages that were affecting safety.
The whole world has critical shortages.
No, but Australia is next door to us.
So they just pay a lot more?
A lot more, a huge amount more. The current pay gap, we commissioned research economist to do work on the pay gap for specialists. It's between 60 and 67%, the pay gap, on basic salaries.
Still?
Now. I'm sure it wasn't that earlier. Because they've had big pay jolts there, and then they've maintained them, not with additional pay jolts, but they've kept up.
So if we accept that there's a specialist shortage worldwide, that we are constantly at risk of losing more, and that we struggle to fill those vacancies you were talking about, how much of the total bill is specialist salaries? Now, I can hear straight away from nurses and others, and I hear you straight away. But let's just focus. This is your area. How much of the bill of your average DHB, average hospital, is the cost of the salaries of those specialists?
I think it will vary, but my sense of it is that probably of the, at least of the salary bill, it might be about 6 to 8%, around that. But in some district health boards, it will be a bit higher because they have less junior doctors for training.
Right.
And in others, it will be about that.
And
maybe 7 to 10% in that vicinity.
It immediately brings pressure then for also adjusting junior doctors' pay and registrars' pay and nurses' pay and everyone else's pay. You can't just move on one area, even if you are the union advocating for them, can you?
Well, no, I think... I think the DHBs and the government and the previous government as well, have a very narrow focus that labour markets should all be the same. One fits all. If you have a particular problem in...
but we have a shortage of nurses as well. We have a shortage of, you know, we've got midwives. People can't get a midwife. And when we look at their pay...
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't just...
Oh, look, I know. No, I accept that. But if you take the... I didn't realise until recently that there's about 100 different allied health professional groups outside nursing and psychologists and many others. Now, they've got negotiations. Even people called perfusionists, I never knew existed.
Sound important.
Well, they sound like... Yeah. I confuse them with percussionists. But some of those don't have shortages. And some of them do. And where you see strikes in that area at the moment is where there are shortages and there's need to do something a bit more than for the rest. And I think there needs to be a more refined analysis of the specific occupational labour markets. Of course, nurses need to be paid more, but they did come to a reasonable a settlement that was contentious, but a settlement nevertheless, and they'll have another go at that next year. The question of resident doctors and training, the issues there are actually quite different. Not pay.
Are you in favour of getting rid of the DHBs? It does sound like the government at the moment is considering whether that model has had its day.
Oh, no, I think actually our DHB system is a legal structure.
But 23 of them?
20. Well, you can argue that. I mean, if you take the area we're in at the moment, if you've got Wellington, Capital & Coast, Hutt Valley, Wairarapa. If you're going to continue to provide the same services in the Wairarapa and the Hutt Valley as we currently provide, then merging into one DHB will make very little difference on that.
Yeah, but the possibility is just moving to a centralised structure again.
Well, then you start to lose contact with the community you fit. District health boards have a very important part in statute of their responsibility to be responsible for a defined population. And it's how you actually do that. And so they do need to be closer. Whether some could come together or not is a secondary question, but we aren't too far from what's right. I'd love to make a final comment.
I want to tell you what a perfusionist is, and I tell you why we should be paying them. They operate the cardiopulmonary bypass machine, heart-lung machine, during cardiac surgery and other surgeries that require cardiopulmonary bypass. So, we need to look after the perfusionists.
Absolutely. I did check that out.
What do you want to finish with, Ian?
Well, I just want to say, just to acknowledge something quite different, and that's the importance of public radio and Radio New Zealand.
You said you're looking for a new role.
Well, it's we'll see how we go. Radio New Zealand actually keeps me sane in terms of the programs such as this, Morning Report, Checkpoint, and its other coverages, because of its commitment to public broadcasting. I know that Radio New Zealand has been restructured many times, but it still seems to punch above its weight very effectively. My life would be miserable without the sensible reporting, debate, discussion on Radio New Zealand. And I just want to acknowledge that over the years, and also to acknowledge also Karen Brown, first, and her predecessor, Ray Lamb. They took that health correspondent role and took it to an exceptionally high level. And I think that the those in the health system have benefited from that, and the public has benefited from that.
Well, Ian, we shall miss you and your availability, which was ever and always, until you pop up in the next role, which won't be far away, I'm sure. Thanks very much.
Thank
After
you.
30 years as the face and leading the Medical Specialists Union, the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, Ian Powell is not retiring, but is moving on, and Sarah Dalton taking over.